programmers, enjoy great music, and partake in good spirits. Music by DJ Rahsaan, Music Relief Radio, Kamal Harris, Beats, Bars, and Bangers, and featuring DJ Divine, Soulful House Sessions. Food by Chef Jarobi of Flavorful Influences. Tickets are $20 and available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW Live. For details, call 202-618-2110. WPFW, changing the world one live event at a time.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington. Welcome to WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. This is the hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. For those listeners who are new to this hour, We the People is a news magazine often reflecting a one-to-one interview regarding race, history, politics, and culture, how they intersect, how they integrate. Folks who deal with those issues leave us a legacy from the past into the present. Those who are present with us do a lot of hard work that should be acknowledged, and we're all responsible for future generations. In keeping with that theme, I'd like to do a few things. First, the housekeeping. A hearty, hearty thank you to those who supported us through our recent winter fundraising drive and our birthday celebration. Due to listeners like you, WPFW has been bringing jazz and justice, serving the collective need and imagination of the communities that we serve, and building a better world one broadcast at a time. Again, due to you, the listener, your financial support, your social connectivity, we thank you for it. I thank you for it. Now, in keeping with our theme, embracing collective cultural memories, Black voices for community and growth. To help us unpack that, we have Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwu-Yor, who is a cultural communication specialist and the founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust. The Trust is a Pan-African initiative that uses communications, media, cultural storytelling to correct and challenge myths or disinformation regarding racial or ethnic identity, anti-Blackness, and false narratives. Its work embraces the collective cultural memories from Black communities and the Pan-African world. Ms. Iwu-Yor is also the publisher of Our Legacy Press, which produces children's books celebrating Black life and culture. Her current book, Black Voices, Inspiring and Empowering Quotes from Global Thought Leaders, supplies this conversation. And good morning and welcome. So nice to have you.
Good morning, David. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, as I do with most guests, if they're associated with an organization or a particular effort, I ask them to tell us about it. Tell us about the National Black Cultural Information Trust.
Yeah, it's everything you just said. It's a Pan-African initiative that fuses cultural education, information. We provide news, information, and resources that uplifts the collective freedom of Black communities. And we use our history, our cultures, and our legacy in order to do that.
We have some studious listeners who are always ready. Can you just identify the website or how people can make contact with the organization?
Sure. NBCIT.org.
NBCIT.org. Okay.
Yes.
And thank you. So you and I know, as well as our listeners know, that African descended people have spoken of many things, particularly to each other. The words follow actions. They have context. They're always shared with a purposefulness and often with the goal of uplift. Now, what we've said, what we've done, who we are, it's not often lifted in mainstream educational settings. So there comes a time in each Black person's life that looks toward the wisdom of the ancestors or elders who are with them for wisdom and life. How did you set out to pick the quotes of this book? And then also, if you could just tell us a little bit about the focus and goals.
Sure. And I'm so glad you raised that point of looking back to the ancestors. This book has really been a journey, Black Voices, Inspiring and Empowering Quotes from Global Thought Leaders. The irony is the original idea of the book did not come from me. I was looking for new ways to teach cultural education, Black history. And my kids were about 5 at the time, and they kept asking me about TikTok. And I was like, I'm old. I'm not going to be on TikTok. But through pressure, I started going on the app more. And I said, okay, I can use this. And so I started different series on Black history through TikTok and gained somewhat of a following, about 50,000, a little over 50,000 people on TikTok. So I was doing a different series on Black history. I was doing series on fake Black history, like mythology that has seeped into historical narratives. And then a publisher contacted me one day from Quarto Publishing Group and Wellfleet Press. And they said, hey, we've seen you on TikTok teaching Black history. We think that we have a book idea that you would be perfect for. And when we went over it, I was like, yeah, this is right up my alley. It was an opportunity to go to do what I love to do most, which is go back and really look at a lot of the teachings, learnings, writings, speeches of our ancestors, but also infuse contemporary artists, activists, politicians, folks that are well known, folks that are lesser known, but uplift all of those voices in a robust way. I had some assistance with a colleague of mine, Remy Johnson, who went to Syracuse University with me, who helped be a researcher. We both graduated from the Pan-African Studies Department there. And so we did a lot of background research together and came up with this collection of quotes. Now, each quote is accompanied with a biography. There's also a bibliography at the end. People can go and look at their own sources and learn more about each person, each figure themselves. And I know we'll get into it some more, but there's also art throughout the book. And the quotes, though, the book is broken up into 11 chapters, and it covers a lot of different themes. And so we were going about the quotes in that way and trying to make sure we get representation from across the Pan-African world. We have African-Americans represented, Afro-Latinos, Africans from the continent, Africans in Europe, African descendants in Canada, really trying to show the robustness of the Pan-African world and our different thoughts and how we're often thinking similar things or at least having converging thoughts on particular topics pertaining to our lives as people of African descent. Now, one thing I can say about how the quotes were selected, some people would think, oh, it's a book of quotes. It's not that hard. I promise it's more than you think.
Yes.
We had at least hundreds of quotes that couldn't get in the book, mostly because you have to get permissions, copyright, book permissions. If it was in a book, if it was in a speech, who owns the speech, who owns the copyright? Some things were in public domain, thank God. And so we were able to easily get in a lot of our ancestors from like the 1800s or early 1900s in there without a problem. But even then, we still have to back up each quote with the source and all these different things. So it is a lot that goes into it. Every quote that we wanted to go in didn't make it. But the ones that we did get in really do show the robustness of the Pan-African world.
And I'm happy for it, having experienced the book. It is just visually beautiful. And I imagine that many readers, once they look at Black voices, inspiring and empowering quotes from global thought leaders, it's a true educational experience. There's something in the design and the momentum, whether you're a fast or slow reader, when you go through the book, it's compelling in all sorts of levels. There's the anxiousness of speeding through it and enjoying the treasure, but there's also, seems as compelling to know that you will go back and look at that book again and again. So that's my high praise for your efforts, and I am very grateful for it. I also want to highlight something you emphasized in what you just said. It's important to understand context and primary sources. Often these primary sources are available to us now, especially due to the internet or the good old library. And if you happen to be in a city like Washington, D.C., there are plenty of independent bookstores and I believe three or four that are Black owned and operated. And so we have a privilege and treasure in following your example and appreciating the work that you present to us. We both alluded to the art. What do you want to say about the engagement of the artist and how you found them and how you worked together? And let me say this, by the way, people can see at least the cover of the book when you check out WPFW's Facebook page. Often many of the programmers put up show announcements that do have an illustration or an example of what's going on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sure. So, as you mentioned earlier, I do have my own publishing company that publishes Black children's books, Our Legacy Press. However, this time was my first time publishing with a major publisher, which is Quarto Publishing Group and Wellfleet Press. And so thankfully, I mean, when you're doing it with your own publishing company, you got to do everything. But with the major publisher, they can handle a lot of the things. So they did take on the task of helping to find the artists and getting the artwork and matching the artwork with my words, with the quotes and the biographies. One thing about the artists is all of them are from across the Pan-African world. So we have artists from Ghana. We have artists from the United States. We have artists from South Africa. We have artists from all over that represent the breadth of the Pan-African world. The cover art is by Aaron K. Robinson. The name is Dada Wazuri. And if you look at the back of the book, there's a whole list of the different artists for anyone that gets the book. And it has their biographies, where you can find them online. And when you're looking at each chapter, there's 11 chapters. There's a like an opening passage written by myself about what the chapter is about. And it's accompanied by beautiful artwork from each of the artists. And then each quote also has art surrounding it and illustrations as well.
The book's about the size of a medium-sized tablet. And I was not talking in jest or lightly when I say to go through it. You're actually stimulated into a learning experience. I can't say that enough about your work. The themes are, like you said, the convergence of Black or African descended people throughout the world. We all have a history. Part of that history is to combat one, a war that was infected with the practice of enslavement in the international slave trade. All the traumas and victories that follow that. Another phase is to be anti-colonial. But even in these larger meta frames of history, the importance of community and the importance of individuals really shine through with these quotes. Before we dive in, can you just say some of the topics so people know how we're going to progress through the show and how the book itself progresses chapter by chapter?
Sure. So the book starts out with an introduction, pretty much an overview, kind of laying the groundwork for what the book is going to go over in terms of Black voices. And it has 11 different chapters. It's culture and history, education and knowledge, justice, civil rights, human rights. There's a chapter on race and racism. There's a chapter on gender, feminism and womanism. There's a chapter on peace and love. Inspiration, hope, and perseverance are together. Freedom and liberation, politics, Blackness, and then we end on Pan-Africanism.
Right. And let me remind listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But more importantly, our guests, Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor, who is a cultural communication specialist. She's the founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust, a Pan-African initiative that uses communications and media and cultural storytelling to challenge and correct myths and disinformation regarding race, ethnic identity, anti-Blackness, and false narratives. We're talking about embracing collective cultural memories, quotes from different people, both past and present, both near you and far, but all across this planet. Well, let's not hesitate. Let's dive in. I am so happy you started with the notion of history and culture. And I hope these heroes and sheroes are familiar to people. If you allow me, I'll do it just once, but I'll let you select the other quotes. But how could we not exist without Arturo Schomburg or John Henrik Clark or Mary McLeod Bethune and others? What we can talk about the quotes, but also their characteristics to these people, which you identify in the introductions. Please go ahead.
Sure. All of the people that you just named are forefathers and foremothers of Africana studies and history. Arturo Schomburg, being an Afro-Puerto Rican, laying the groundwork for really saving, harvesting, loving on African-American culture and history. So now we have the Schomburg Center named after him. And him being such a forefather in this, that he inspires Dr. John Henrik Clark, who looks up to him and becomes this powerhouse of Africana studies and history. Dr. Clark makes us love ourselves. Like, you can't not love being yourself as a person of African descent after you listen to Dr. Clark. And Mary McLeod Bethune is a mother of mothers. I mean, this is a woman who wanted to be a, she wanted to, she was, gosh, what was the name for it that they do when they go? She wanted to be a missionary. Mary McLeod-Bethune wanted to be a missionary and go to Africa. That was her dream job. And the white folks that educated Mary McLeod-Bethune said, they're not sending you there. They said, they're not sending her to Africa, and it hurt. But like she says in the book, the drums of Africa still beats in her heart, and she's not going to rest until every Negro child is able to prove their worth. And so there's a connection there. She has Mary McLeod-Bethune's legacy is with us now with Bethune-Cookman, and all of those that were educated there are her children. I mean, because of her vision with creating a school for Black girls, that grew exponentially to what we have today. It's an ongoing legacy. All three of them, Schomburg, Clark, and Bethune, are ongoing legacies that we continue to thrive from. And so I had to start the book with them because they laid the groundwork for our history, but also our future. We have to continue, like with Sankofa, looking backwards in order to go forward. So I had to start the book with them.
And what shines through is they didn't have an easy time of it, both in their personal lives and in their social context. Yet, amazingly, it's not that they broke off a little piece of effort, but they really dedicated their lives to knowledge that moves beyond information. You know, mere information, a mere factoid, that's one thing, but to have a service to people where you're accountable to a specific community, you're accountable to other individuals, and you practice what you do, all three of them and the other examples represent that. And sometimes we need a good word, do we not?
Yes.
You know, the Arturo Schomburg quote says something to the effect that we need historians and philosophers, and that they're very needful in that. You know, as we go along, feel free. I'm going to defer to you because the unrestraint in enjoying your book, I want to make sure you pick and select the quotes you would like for our listeners to hear. And again, even before we move on, you know, we passed through Black History Month, and it's good to have a time of deliberate commemoration and celebration. But what the book achieves is these are not floating factoids or just quotes out there. And I think the fact that your artist and the references that are in the book would lead somebody, especially if they're dealing with people growing up, to really understand context and purpose in the quotes. So that being said, we're naturally moving on to education and knowledge. And what did the voices tell us about where education can lead us?
Let me get there with you. But I think that the voices are telling us that education can lead us to freedom. Education leads us to pathways that were unknown to us before and guide us towards what we are seeking to achieve, which is ultimately, if you look at the Pan-African world, various ideals of freedom and liberation, which we get to more in the book later. But education is basically a tool for empowerment, for growth, for coming together and advancing.
And if you would, I will ask two quotes that stood out to me were, well, we have the psychologist, Dr. Akbar, who talks about how children and youth's natural talents can be applied broadly. He says, if I'm not taking away from you, that even when you see a child enjoying sports or the arts, it's not contrary to how that child in spirit and in its intellect can excel in the sciences, in history, in literature, and so forth. And in this chapter, two other quotes that stood out in particular from Prince Hall and W.E.B. Du Bois. I wonder if you could read either of those and talk about them.
Sure. So the Prince Hall quote, "Although you are deprived of the means of education, yet you are not deprived of the means of meditation, by which I mean thinking, hearing, and weighing matters, men and things in your own mind, and making that judgment of them as you think reasonable to satisfy your minds and give an answer to those who may ask you a question. This nature hath furnished with you without letter learning, and some have made great progress therein." So he's speaking of the fact that, you know, during his time, a lot of our ancestors did not have access to reading and writing. I do want to dispel the myth that none of them could read and write, because many could, but many could not at the same time. And so he is saying that, yes, you've been deprived of educational resources, but you also have a internal means of education and reflection. And by using what you have within, which is funny because Nain Akbar later writes, "Know thyself," you know, so there's interconnections here with the quotes, but there's an inner learning and a ways of being that you can access and tap into in order to find success and move forward. And a lot of our ancestors did do that. A lot of our ancestors were finding a means to, like we say, make a way out of no way. They were creating businesses. They were having secret schools, teaching each other how to read and write. They were doing all kinds of things that you would think that would be impossible at a time period that you would think it impossible. So I think Prince Hall is speaking to that here.
And let's just identify him for those people who are not familiar with him. He was part of the Boston community, ardent abolitionist, and if I'm not mistaken, the founder of Black Freemasonry.
Yes.
I've got everything correct.
So we have the Prince Hall Masons. They come after the, he was the founder of the African Lodge, African Lodge One. And which is also interesting, because sometimes there's people that try to disconnect the Africanity of African Americans. And many of our ancestors told us who we were many times. And so Prince Hall founding African Lodge and being the forefather of Black Masonry is very profound in a key aspect of our history to understand. And he was an abolitionist. He was an activist. He built institutions. He really managed to do so much in his lifetime in the early in the 1700s, 1800s.
And since we're in the Boston, New England, and Massachusetts area, let's honor Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, whose, by the way, birthday was February 23rd, 1868. He was born in Barrington, Massachusetts. And if there's not a more powerful intellectual figure spanning the point of two centuries, I don't know who that would be except for Dr. Du Bois. Some say he was the founder of American sociology.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if you please, could you read that quote, and then we'll come up on our break.
Sure. And then I have one quote from a woman I want to share in this section.
Sure.
But the Du Bois quote is, "The function of the university is not simply to teach breadwinning or to furnish teachers for the public schools or to be a center of polite society. It is, above all, to be the organ of that fine adjustment between real life and the growing knowledge of life, and the adjustment which forms the secret of civilization."
Well, just let that stand in its power. Mm-hmm. And before we get a break, you wanted to uplift a sister, a woman.
Yes, I wanted to uplift Dr. Mishariga Thaimugo, who was a Kenyan playwright and poet. She was actually one of my mentors. She taught me at Syracuse University. She passed away last year, but she taught us interesting aspects of education and knowledge as well from the Kenyan Kikuyu tradition. She says, "The African orator heritage connects me to my African indigenous sites of knowledge, where I learn stories, myths, legends, riddles, proverbs, poems, and songs, etc., that remind me that our mothers, grandmothers, and aunties were, are, some of our most treasured gifts as educators and artists."
Amen and ashe to that.
Ashe.
You're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. In this hour, We the People, we're embracing collective cultural memories, Black voices for community growth, for community and growth, excuse me. To help us with that, Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwu-Yor is a cultural communication specialist who's produced her recent book, Black Voices, Inspiring and Empowering Quotes from Global Thought Leaders. We thank you for listening to this hour and to WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station. We're in the halfway point of our show, and as a service to you, we come forth with public service announcements. Won't you stay with us as we further our conversation for the remainder of the hour? We'll be right back, and again, thank you for listening.
Celebrating 20 years, the New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project, brings the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora to the DMV at the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 15th to the 28th. The festival features 26 films from 16 countries, including 3 years premieres and discussions with filmmakers. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2024 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver. Or call 301-495-6700. 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People right here at 89.3 FM, WPFW, WPFWFM.org. You heard the wonderful dulcet tones of Mwiza Mutale, who's the host and producer of Africa Now, which is broadcast 1 p.m. Eastern on Wednesdays right here on this station. Africa Now focuses on African-descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora, throughout the world. Culture, history, politics, and all sorts of things are covered by that wonderful show. Today, if you're listening live, you will know that coming up, he has a special focus on C.L.R. James, an important, again, world-shaking leader from the Caribbean. That's right here on WPFW, where many of the programmers not only bring you their shows either through the broadcast air or online, but also they archive the shows at our page, again, at WPFWFM.org. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting WPFW. Miss Iwu-Yor, thank you for being with us. Again, the uplift of Black voices throughout the ages can do everyone such great good, and I'm so happy for it. African descended people, wherever they're at across the globe, ask themselves and seek justice. What does justice look like? What are the voices that you summon telling us about it? So our words are not pleas and they're not reactions. There's something more. They include truth telling. Again, tell us about it, if you please.
Sure. I think for us, justice looks like so many different things. In the book, I say that justice is the work enacted to right wrongs and ensure that pain, anguish, and trauma never happen again. it's the work toward ensuring that the civil and human rights of communities and individuals remain secure and protected. I think it's even more than that, of course. I think that justice is more than righting wrongs. It is healing. It is the restoration of the soul. And so I think for a lot of us, there's this ongoing search for justice. And I think part of that would be a level of peace and serenity that comes with knowing that the harm is no longer there, but additionally, the future is secured and bright and protected as well.
To illustrate that, again, trying to use restraint here because your book's altogether wonderful, I will not do more than ask you about two quotes so you have room to lift up the quotes you want to lift up. But Frantz Fanon and Ida B. Wells, two outstanding people in our history. Can you maybe share those quotes? And
sure.
Let's go a little further then.
Okay, so the Fanon quote, each generation in relative opacity must discover its mission, fulfill it, or otherwise betray it. So with Fanon, I think what he's uplifting here is there's this, like I was saying earlier, it's an ongoing search for justice. But it's interconnected because each generation takes that mantle. Right now, one example of that is the reparations movement. We have Queen Mother Audley Moore. Before her, we have Callie House. We have all these key figures, reparations, Raymond Jenkins, so many key figures that have passed on. And then we have our elders. And working in the reparations movement, now you can literally see how the torch is being passed. There's this amazing organization called Get Free out of New York that put pressure on the governor to go ahead and sign that legislation to get a reparations bill passed recently. And I think it's just a wonderful example of each generation discovering its mission and seeking to fulfill it and taking on that the continuous work that our ancestors and elders laid the groundwork for.
I want to make sure some listeners caught, you mentioned many names, but Callie, Callie House, mm-hmm. is a name you should look up. Her idea was that reparations are indeed practical and concrete. And she didn't fool around. If I'm not mistaken, she has some wrestling to do in the courts as well. But she was also the leader of the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Society. And that will tell you about this important 19th century figure. Frantz Fanon is just a phenomenal human being and scholar and intellect. In his discipline of psychology, he really gets at the underpinnings of why colonialism and racial capitalism are very, very bad. And coming from Martinique, he influenced the world. He was concerned about French colonialism in particular, for obvious reasons, important to Algerians, important to the struggle, not only the pain, but the struggle and striving of having healthy mental health and consciousness in the face of oppression. The Wretched of the Earth, Black Skin, White Mask, these are important books to look up. I mentioned Ida B. Wells. Talk about truth-telling and courage and strength.
Yes, and her quote here is, if this work can contribute in any way toward proving this, and at the same time arouse the conscience of the American people to a demand for justice for every citizen and punishment by law for the lawless, I shall feel I have done my race a service. So Ida B. Wells here, she's a journalist. She's a leading African-American journalist and activist. And one of the things she was doing was tracing and documenting lynchings. And at the time, mainstream media was not covering these lynchings, or at least covering them in depth or truthfully. And so the community relied on Black media, Black-led news, Black journalists to document and tell these truths about what is happening and try to put pressure on the government to hold these murderers basically accountable for what they are doing. And so she published a pamphlet titled Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases in 1892. And she also wrote for other multiple newsletters across the country. And so she is speaking of justice from the framework of being able to document, being able to truth tell and hold this country accountable for the ills that it was allowing.
Well, we're moving right along. The Pan-African world has challenged race and racism throughout the ages. Its demonstrations of strength, courage, honor, and integrity. Your chapter contains many contemporary voices as far as race and racism is concerned. But before you get into maybe those contemporary voices, it was notable that Benjamin Banneker was a clear-throated advocate for our full humanity and what is to be right by us. Explain however you want or utilize the quote, but Banneker, besides being a master designer of Washington, D.C., and even points as far north as Baltimore, and well-regarded by whites and blacks and even foreign dignitaries, tell us about Benjamin Banneker and this quote of his.
Sure, I'll read the quote and give some additional context. So Benjamin Banneker writes to Thomas Jefferson, "Sir, I freely and cheerfully acknowledge that I am of the African race, and in that color, which is natural to them of the deepest dye, it is under a sense of the most profound gratitude to the supreme ruler of the universe that I now confess to you that I am not under that state of tyrannical thraldom and inhumane captivity to which too many of my brethren are doomed, but that I have abundantly tasted of the fruition of those blessings which proceed from that free and unequaled liberty with which you are favored and which I hope you will willingly allow you have received from the immediate hand of that being from whom proceedeth every good and perfect gift." So what Benjamin Banneker here is, let me go back. A lot of times we think about him as mathematician, astronomer, surveyor, all of the good things. He got Washington, D.C. together, right? People don't think of Benjamin Banneker as an abolitionist, but he was. And he's saying here in his writings, look, I'm free. I'm not under that tyrannical state that my brethren are under. I'm not enslaved. I've tasted freedom. You are saying that you want liberty, but it's not equal. And I want my brethren to have that same freedom. And I hope that you will acknowledge that and make that a part of the progress of this nation. So Benjamin Banneker is, at this time, you would think it would be hard to speak out as a free Black person on behalf of enslaved African-Americans, because you don't want to be in that same condition, so maybe you would just be quiet. Not Benjamin Banneker. He said, "That's not enough. I'm proud to be of the African race. I'm proud to be who I am, and I don't like to see what is happening with my brethren." So he's advocating for our freedom, and he's throwing the hypocrisy of the United States creation built on liberty and freedom in the face of Thomas Jefferson and writing him directly that and advocating for the freedom and abolition of African people.
Yeah, and if people followed the quote that you read, he's also calling people out on their theology, because there's a reference to the faith commitments of everybody involved. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes boldness and threatening sacrifice, which is sometimes actualized, for Black people to speak out for themselves and for all who look like them. And the contemporary journalist Farai Chidea, you quoted her, and she is part of an assemblage of quotes in there, just talking about the plain necessity of confronting. Can you say something about this confrontational mandate?
Sure. So Farai Chidea says, the first step in resolving some of the tension between the races in this country is to talk about these issues honestly. Racism unexamined will always be racism unresolved. I think that quote is powerful because you can see that happening right now, that we're having these attacks on DEI, these attacks on Black history. And it's the prime example of racism unexamined will be racism unresolved, because there's powers that be that don't want it to be resolved. So they don't want our children examining critical race theory, don't want our students looking into and delving into diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so it is purposeful to let this issue remain unresolved. And that is why it is the job of people who want to bend the arc of justice to consistently bring these issues to the forefront and speak truth to power, because it's more than an issue of differences. This is life or death. Racism impacts lives, affects lives in a major way, the lives of people of African descent. And so we have to continue to bring these issues to the forefront.
And the conditions you just described, I believe you have a Mr. Stevenson. I'm not so much asking you to read it, but there's examples from Canada, from England, and yeah, elsewhere. And those quotes are so, so similar, like you're saying. Well, in order to have courage, in order to have innovation, creativity, and inventiveness, and just to enjoy life, it takes self-love. And two of the best examples through your quotes are bell hooks and Thomas Sankara. I wonder if you can just talk about what these quotes give you on the perspective of self-love that Black folk, African descended folk must have.
Yes. So bell hooks, African-American feminist scholar, she's the author of a book on love that I really enjoyed reading. She says, I'm very interested in what does it mean for us to cultivate together community that allows for risk, the risk of knowing someone outside your own boundaries, the risk that is love. There is no love that does not involve risk. And so I think ultimately what bell hooks is speaking to here is going beyond the fear of building community. A lot of people have various reasons for being afraid of the collective, but ultimately it's a risk worth taking. And it's something that a lot of our ancestors would not have survived without if they had not cultivated community. They cultivated community through religious institutions, but these institutions were more than religious institutions. They were safe houses. They were places where people got food and health care for free. They cultivated together in terms of raising children, in terms of livelihood, in terms of farming, in a lot of different ways. I was even reading about this concept of shipmate family members, where sometimes if a group of people came together on a slave ship and they were able to at least live on the same plantation, they would regard some of these, the people that they came over with as automatic aunts or uncles to their children that were born enslaved. It's called like a shipmate family. Lord, I wish I could remember the name of the author, but he's the father of Gullah Geechee history and culture. And if I remember before the end of this segment, I'll raise up his name. But then cultivating community is very important for self-love, because also it takes all of the burden off of yourself and allows you to be able to breathe and grow.
I can summarize why Thomas Sankara, who's an amazing revolutionary, had a very simple message for us, and that is not to be so mean and disrespectful to one another. I mean, he just says it plainly, that in order for us to advance and grow, in order for us to have community, he really urged on a micro level, treat everybody right. We're closing in on our time. I certainly want to thank you and reintroduce you, but the important thing is a couple of things. We want to have a legacy that's not only of survival, but of thriving and human flourishing. So how do you want to tie this all together for us?
I want to tie this together with the fact that, just like what you said, we're more than the harms that we've endured. We're more than the trauma that we have endured. We are world makers. We are innovators. And that is something that is also uplifted throughout this book, which is why we have all those different sections showcasing the creativity, the knowledge, the love, the innovation. And that is something that also needs to continuously be uplifted. Showcasing the love that we have for ourselves and each other, showcasing what we have to offer ourselves in the world. And I think that is an important piece to really understanding who we are as human beings and people of African descent.
Well, Jessica Ann Mitchell, I thank you. I thank you for being with us in this hour and for your book, Black Voices, Inspiring and Empowering Quotes from Global Thought Leaders. Let me ask, do you have any readings coming up? I think people could really benefit from interacting and seeing you in public.
I just had a couple of them. I was at the Asala Luncheon. I will be at the African American Cultural Expo and Children's Book Fair. That is July the 27th in Waldorf, Maryland. It is an event hosted by the National Black Cultural Information Trust. You can learn about it at culturalexpo.eventbrite.com. The information is there and registration is free. So I will be there, and there will be copies of the book, and I will be going over the book.
And to keep up with you, again, we urge people to go to the National Black Cultural Information Trust website, nbcit.org. Thank you so much for spending the hour. We try to do justice. There is more treasure than the hour allowed us to have, but it's so important. It's so important for anyone, any human being, to embrace cultural memories, to understand what was said, what was done, and what people did. And it is relevant to today. So again, I thank you.
Thank you so much, David, for having me on and sharing the book with your listeners.
You're welcome. My thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer, the News and Public Affairs Departments of WPFW, to the remainder of the staff as well. And importantly, you, the listener, for not only financially supporting us, but your social connectivity is very, very important. Coming up next, as we do every noon hour during the weekday, don't forget the blues, the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. Again, let me remind you about Africa Now at 1 p.m. At 2, Zain El Amin talks about Middle Eastern affairs and Shea Wanana. At 3, Sophie's Parlor. Given to you by the oldest established women's collective in media that covers music and culture. My thanks to you for listening. Coming up next, and again, thank you for listening. Take good care.
time love and our sweat leaves us.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, March 27th. Here are some headlines. The U.S. Coast Guard late yesterday transitioned from an active search to a recovery effort for six construction workers who are now presumed dead and who were on Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge when it collapsed yesterday after one of its support pillars was struck by a container ship that lost power. Meanwhile, the National Transportation Safety Board has recovered the ship's black box data recorder, which will help develop a timeline of events leading up to the crash as investigators seek to understand what caused it. President Biden said he expects the federal government will pay for the entire cost of rebuilding the bridge, which could take up to a year. The president called on Congress to support efforts to fund the repairs. Speaking to the larger impact of the catastrophe, U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg warned yesterday that the ongoing closure of a crucial East Coast shipping channel will not be felt just at the local level, but on a macro scale. Speaking at a news conference, he said, quote, "The port here in Baltimore does the most vehicle handling of any port at all. You also have container traffic, you have boat traffic. There is no question that this will have a major and protracted impact on supply chains," close quote. In other news, NBC News yesterday ousted former Republican National Committee Chair Rona McDaniel less than a week after she joined the network as a paid political analyst. McDaniel's appointment was immediately criticized by some of the network's biggest stars and by viewers on social media. MSNBC's Rachel Maddow devoted more than a half hour of her primetime program on Monday to the controversy, saying the decision to hire McDaniel was inexplicable. McDaniel, who recently stepped down from the RNC under pressure from former President Donald Trump, was involved in various attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. In international news, Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, told the UN's Human Rights Council yesterday that she believed that Israel's military campaign in Gaza since October 7th amounted to genocide. The 1948 Genocide Convention, enacted in the wake of the Nazi Holocaust, defines genocide as, quote, "acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group," close quote. During the briefing, Albanese stated, quote, "I find there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met," close quote. She called on countries to immediately impose sanctions and an arms embargo. Israel did not attend the session and rejected her findings. And a Russian court yesterday extended by 3 months the pre-trial detention of Evan Gershkovich, a Wall Street Journal reporter arrested a year ago this Friday on espionage charges. The reporter was detained while on a reporting assignment in the Ural Mountains and later accused of trying to obtain state secrets. Gershkovich and the Wall Street Journal strongly deny the charges, which carry a sentence of up to 20.